sahana vavatu, sahano bhunaktu, sahavidyan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu mavidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shantihi. Good. Welcome back. We continue in our study of Chapter 7. Last week we began our study of Chapter 7, Jnana Vijnana Yoga. It's the first of the chapters in which the topic of discussion shifts to Ishvara, who is Ishvara. We'll see that as we continue. Let's begin. Excuse me. Let's begin with some chanting, starting from the beginning of the chapter. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Shri Bhagavan Maya Saktamana Partha, Maya Saktamana Yogam Yunjan Mara Shrayaha, Yogam Yunjan Mara Asam Shayam Samagramam, Asam Shayam Sam. Yatha jnasyasi tachrinu, yatha jnasyasi. Jnanam teham savijnanam, jnanam teham. Idam vakshyamya sheshatah, idam vakshyama shesh. Yad jnatva neha bhuyonyata, yad jnatva neha. Jnatavyamavashishyate, jnatavyamavashishyate, manushyanam sahasreshu, manushyanam, kashchid yatati siddhaye, kashchid yatati, yatatamapi siddhanam, yatatamapi, kashchin mam veti tatvatah, kashchin mam veti, Bhumirapo nalo vayuhu, bhumirapo nalo. Kammano buddhirevacha, kammano buddhirevacha. Ahankara hiti yamme, ahankara hiti. Bhinna prakriti rashtadha, bhinna prakriti. Aparheyamitas tvanyam, aparheyamitas. Prakritim vidhi me param, prakritim vidhi me param. Jiva bhuta mahabaho, jiva bhuta. Yayedam dharyate jagata, yayedam dharyate. Etad yonini bhutani, etad yonini. Sarvani tupadharaya, sarvani tupad. Aham kritsnasya jagataha, aham kritsnasya. Prabhava pralayastata, prabhava pralay. Matta parataram nanyata, matta parat. Kinchirasti dhananjaya, kinchirasti dhana. Mayi sarvamidam protam, mayi sarva. Sutre maniganahiva, sutre manig. Rasohamapsu kaunteya, rasohamapsu. Prabhasmi shashi surya yoho, prabhasmi shashi. Pranava sarva vedeshu, pranava sarva. Shabda ke paurusham drishu, shabda ke punyo gandha prativyam cha, punyo gandha prativ tejas chasmi vibhavasau, tejas chasmi vib jivanam sarva bhuteshu, jivanam sarva. Tapas chasmi tapasvishu, tapas chasmi tapas. Bijam ham sarva bhutanam, bijam ham. Vidhi partha sanatanam, vidhi. Buddhir buddhimatam asmi. Buddhir Tejas tejasvi namaham. Tejas tejasvi namaham. Good. In our prior class, we saw just the first three verses which introduced the text, talking about jnanam, knowledge, wisdom, and vijnanam. This is the title of the chapter, Jnana Vijnana Yoga, jnanam, knowledge, and knowledge here of Ishvara, who is the source of creation, and vijnanam, which, as we discussed, describes a knowledge accompanied by a personal factor of experience, personal factor of relating to that knowledge in a very immediate way, not in an abstract, intellectual, or theoretical way. Before we continue with these verses, we received a couple of questions which are relevant. The first question actually picks up from our prior chapter. At the end of chapter 6, we had the discussion about what happens to the yoga brashta, someone who's committed to a life of spiritual growth, but dies before reaching enlightenment. And with regard to that that subject matter, the question is, samskaras born of intense practice have an effect on the next janma. We discussed how, in addition to the karmic effect from life to life, there's a samskara that can affect an immediate succeeding life. But what about spiritual practice that is not so intense, which means mild spiritual practice that's not intense enough to really create that kind of samskara? A samskara will only be created by really intense practice. So according to karma theory, that is the effects of that modest sadhana, the effects, the karma pala, will go into the infinite pool, the sanchitta karma, you remember our discussion, and get diluted in that infinite pool. If so, do we restart our spiritual sadhana right from the bottom during every janma? Is it, you remember that board game where you have to go back to Go or something? What is that? I don't even remember what that game is. Whatever it is, you have to go back to the starting point. And so the question here is, do we have to go back to the starting point, start over from ground zero, as it were, in terms of sadhana every life? Wait a minute. Who says that in your next life you'll be born as a human being? Seriously. Don't take that for granted. There's no rule. And occasionally someone will teach that once you've been born as a human being, you're guaranteed that you'll always be born as a human being. There's no rule. When it comes to karma, the complexity of karma is such that you can't make any broad, definite statement about what will happen in your next janma or any janma. So your next janma, you might get born in some kind of heavenly domain. You might get born as a cockroach. Anything is possible, which is why, and we saw this in our Vedanta class when we were reading some of Shankara's commentary. Shankara says, and excuse, I'll paraphrase it in modern American English. Shankara says, don't mess around. This is your chance. Put all your effort into sadhana in this life. There's no guarantee in your next life you're going to pick up the thread. There's not even a guarantee you'll be born as a human being in your next life. So the emphasis then is on spiritual growth now. And sadly, one of the ways in which the doctrine of karma is misused is to say, oh, it's okay if things don't go well for me in this life, it's okay because I'll get born again and I can do better the next time. This is a terrible distortion. And let me say it very clearly, it's a harmful distortion of the teachings of karma. Because it gives you permission to be a, in more American English, it gives you permission to be a slacker in this life. But the ancient rishis and our great saints never said we have permission to take it easy in this life. And again, what we saw in Sri Shankaracharya's commentary, he said, you make all possible effort in this life itself because you don't know what will happen in your next life. So this is the one that counts. Okay. The second and last question is actually with regard to the beginning of this chapter. We noticed a dramatic shift of subject matter when we left the first six chapters behind and started the middle six chapters of our study. And in the middle six chapters, we see the emphasis shifting from the individual to Ishvara, from Jiva to Ishvara. So with regard to that, the question comes, Swamiji, what is the difference between Ishvara and Satchidananda Atma? In the following chapters, do we put aside our understanding of Atma so far and focus on Ishvara, Ishvara of the world outside ourselves, Ishvara and the world outside ourselves? There is that shift of subject matters. Not that we set Satchidananda Atma aside. Satchidananda Atma is a teaching about the truth of your nature. It's a fundamental reality. And we should say it's a non-relational reality. You don't relate to Satchidananda Atma. You are Satchidananda Atma. But we find in life that we relate to other people, we relate to the world around us, and we relate to Ishvara. So in this middle six chapters, and we're going to see the subject matter starting right now in today's class, we relate to not only the world, but the world that has a source, that source that we call Ishvara. So we need, as part of our process of spiritual growth, we need to understand what is the world, what is the source of the world, and who is that Ishvara from whom the world came forth, the one to whom we are related as Ishvara and Jiva. So a process of spiritual growth will not be complete unless we also focus on the world around us and its source. If the focus of the first six chapters was all inwards, what about out there? So you turn your attention within, and this more or less summarizes the teachings of Vedanta. You turn your attention within, and you can discover the truth of yourself, but then eventually you have to open your eyes and deal with the world around you. So the Vedantic teachings then proceed to go in that direction, out into the world around us, and then obviously to the source of that world around us, to that Ishvara. So it's not that Satchidananda Atma is set aside. In fact, the relationship we'll see, even I think a little bit in today's class, Satchidananda Atma is the truth of you, the truth of me, the truth of every living being, the truth of every creature, the truth of every sentient entity, and the truth of Ishvara. The truth of you and the truth of Ishvara are not two different realities. The reality because of which you exist and the reality because of which Ishvara exists is the same reality. So in that sense, we're not setting Satchidananda Atma or the teachings of the first six chapters. They're not set aside, but rather the emphasis shifts as we go into the middle six chapters. Okay. After those questions, now we can pick up the thread and continue with verse 4. So the first three verses were introduction, and really the teachings of chapter 7 begin with this fourth verse.
Bhumirapunalo vayuhu, bhumirapunalo kammano buddhirevacha, kammano buddhirevacha, ahankara iti yamme, ahankara iti Bhinna prakriti rashtadha, bhinna prakriti rashtadha.
So first we begin with a list. What is a list? Bhumihi, earth. Apaha, water. Analaha, fire. Vayuhu, air, and kam, space, akasham, are five fundamental elements. So how obvious it is that the emphasis has shifted from looking within. Last chapter was all meditation, right? Dhyana yoga was chapter six. In chapter six, in the prior verses, the focus was definitely within. Now our focus shifts to looking out into the world around us. And what is the first thing we see? We see stuff, which in ancient times was defined in terms of these five fundamental elements. And just a quick aside here, because it can be an issue for some people. Some people have a doubt. When you were in a science class, how many elements did you learn about in a chemistry class? There were more than 100, right? So there are more than 100, and here we get a list of five. And then to make matters worse, one of the five is space. Space is an element? Now, these teachings may look archaic from a modern standpoint. They are archaic from a modern standpoint. These teachings are 3,000-4,000 years old. This fivefold division is probably 3,000 years old. By the way, prior to this fivefold division, there was actually a Trivrit Karana. There was actually a teaching found in Chandogya Upanishad and some other places of only three elements. So here we're getting the up. Even as in modern times, they keep discovering new elements. So apparently there was some evolution even in ancient times. So they started with three elements. They arrived finally at five. We've discussed this briefly before, that we shouldn't confuse Vedanta and science. Science teaches us about the world around us, and science is based on sense perception with the help of instruments which amplify our sense perception, and then with some reasoning and logic which extend whatever we learn. So this is what science is about. Science is about the perceptible world around us. The subject matter of the Bhagavad Gita and the subject matter of Vedanta in general is not the world around us. So when the Bhagavad Gita or some other scripture talks about five elements, it's not a statement of scientific validity, but rather it's what the ancient rishis understood the world to be in this pre-scientific world and time. Now, the reason I'm making a little bit of a point here is that some other religions really get stuck on this issue. So if you go through the dates in the Bible, you can work the timeline backwards and discover that the world was created approximately 4,000 BC. Now, that's according to the Bible. That's according to working out all the dates in the Bible. And somebody might have a conflict now. If the world was created 4,000 BC, it means that there's no such thing as evolution. God created all the creatures exactly as they are today. So evolution is out and all natural science is out. What about million-year-old dinosaurs? They're out. So we end up in some cases, people will create a conflict between religion and science, which I think is really unfortunate. The Bible, and this is an opinion. You don't have to, especially if I'm going to talk about the Bible, I don't speak from a matter of authority, although I was raised a Christian. So consider this an opinion. The Bible is not a science book. Doesn't that make sense? It's not a book on science. If you want to study science, pick up a book on science, chemistry, geography, geology, something on science, physics. If you want to study religion, pick up the Bible. Or better, pick up the Bhagavad Gita. I'm a little biased, don't you think? The confusion comes if we look to a scripture for scientific teachings. Equally, confusion comes if we look to science for spiritual teachings. Science doesn't teach us about the truth of who you are. Science doesn't teach us about who and what is the source of the cosmos. And if a scientist makes pronouncements about the truth of who you are or the truth of the cosmos, that science is not speaking as a scientist. The scientist is giving you their own personal religious opinion is what they're doing. Similarly, if a religious person says, oh, there's no such thing as evolution, or remember what the Roman Catholics said 400 or 500 years ago, they insisted, in spite of modern scientific evidence, they insisted that the sun goes around the earth. Even though Copernicus has shown mathematically that it wasn't so, even Galileo had shown experimentally that it wasn't so, even still, the Roman Catholic Church insisted that the earth was circled by the sun. What a shame. How unnecessary it is. If religions confine themselves to religious thought and science confines itself to scientific thought, there's no problem at all. So coming back to our text, when the Bhagavad Gita or any Hindu scripture makes a statement about the world, it's only a statement that reflects a world view at the time and place that the scripture had its origin. It is not a pronouncement of scientific truth. There are not five elements, and space most certainly is not an element, but if you go back to this ancient pre-scientific culture, that's how they understood the world. So they have to explain the world in terms of how they understood it then, right? They can't explain the world in terms of 104 elements because they didn't know 104 elements. We can't blame them for that. So they're going to explain the world in terms of their worldview. Their worldview was five elements. But they also were smart enough to know that the world is not merely made of stuff. There's other things in the world in addition to these elements, such as manas, mind, buddhi, intellect, ahankara, ego. These three are added. And in some sense, it's a little bit arbitrary. They're adding these three. They could add more. They could add less. But this is what's given to us by Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. An accounting of the world around us. The world around us is not merely stuff, flesh and bone, but the world around us includes sentient creatures like you and me. So therefore, to accommodate that, they've added three more. Manas, mind, buddhi, intellect, and ahankara, ego. So five elements plus these three give you eight elements. Ashtadha is the final word of the verse. Ashtadha prakritihi is what we're talking about. So to finish this verse now, so these five elements plus mind, intellect, and ego, iti, thus, iam, this, this is me, my, bhinna, differentiated, ashtadha, eightfold, prakritihi, prakriti, nature. Ashtadha prakriti, nature having eight elements, eight aspects. So we would look at nature in a very different way. Today we could look at nature in an even more simple way. We could say nature is matter and energy. So you can boil it down to two factors, or we can talk about the hundred whatever elements there are and whatever. However, the point I'm making or trying to make is it's a little bit arbitrary how we divide up the world around us. One thing we know, though, is the world around us is bhinna. There are many divisions in the world around us. What's given here is ashtadha bhinna, an eightfold division of the world around us. Again, the fact that it's eightfold is a little bit arbitrary. What the verse is telling us, when the emphasis of the verse is not on the eightfoldness of the world around us, that's science, right? The emphasis here is on the fact that this eightfold nature, ashtadha prakriti, this eightfold nature, Sri Krishna says, it's me prakriti. This is my nature, my eightfold nature. And Shankara, just to make it really clear, he says, prakriti me. What do you mean by my nature? Mama Aishwari Maya Shakti. Shaktihi. My divine, and Shankara uses the term Maya Shakti, my power of Maya. And when the word Maya is used in this context, Maya should be understood as a creative capacity. Maya Shakti means a creative capacity. So here Sri Krishna says, this is me, Aishwari, Maya Shaktihi. This is my eightfold creative capacity. I create the world through these eight means, through these eight aspects or elements. Now, why, if the subject matter is Ishvara, why do we begin with a discussion of the world? In fact, if you want to understand Ishvara, it's the most obvious place to begin. Because if you want to know Ishvara, look around and please tell me, where is Ishvara? You look around, you don't see Ishvara, but you do see a world around you. And what we do, what Sri Krishna does and what the teachings of Vedanta do, what the ancient rishis did, is we begin with the world and work our way towards Ishvara. This is a very important philosophical principle. You begin with the effect and work your way towards the cause. Because the cause is not visible, the effect is visible. So it's like if you want to know about clay, you start with a pot. The pot is the effect. Clay is the underlying reality, but what we begin with is what we see, and what we see before us is a pot. So we begin with the effect. We work our way in terms of understanding towards the cause. In the same way here in this chapter, we begin with the world around us, which is the effect, and from that we work our way towards the cause, which is Ishvara. So this is our beginning point. Me bhinna prakriti ashtadha. This is my eightfold nature. This is my manifestation. Sri Krishna, just one final comment here before we move on. When Sri Krishna speaks in the first person in the Bhagavad Gita, which he often does, we have to be a little careful because Sri Krishna refers to himself in different manners, depending on the context. In some places, Sri Krishna refers to himself as Arjuna's charioteer. Well, Arjuna's charioteer is not the source of the universe. Arjuna's charioteer is Sri Krishna, Arjuna's charioteer. Other places, Sri Krishna will refer to himself in chapter 11 as that Vishwarupa, as that cosmic form. Here, Sri Krishna refers to himself as Sakshat Ishvara, as the source of the world. So just to understand, he's not referring to himself as an individual avatara, incarnation. He's referring to himself specifically as Ishvara. All right. We can continue. Aparhe amitas tvanyam, aparhe amitas prakritim vidhi me param, prakritim vidhi jiva bhuta mahabaho, jiva bhuta yayedam dharyate jagat, yayedam dharyate. Apareyam itaha tu anyam. For our Sanskrit students, what a great line. You have to break apart all the sandhis. So in Sanskrit, words are run together, and where they're run together, spelling changes. You have to separate them apart, which is called vicheda. If we separate them apart, it becomes apara iam itaha tu anyam, breaking all the words apart. All right. Apareyam itaha. Apara iam. Itaha, or apareyam. Itaha, other than iam, this, which is apara, which is lower. So he's going to make a distinction now between apara and para. Apara meaning lower, and para meaning higher. So the prior verse is talking about that which is apara, lower. This verse will talk about that which is para, higher. So he is saying, ittaha, beyond that which is apara, lower, referring to his lower nature, this ashtadha prakriti of the prior verse, Sri Krishna says, that is my lower nature, apara. And he says, in addition to that too, on the other hand, there is an anyam prakritim, another prakriti, another nature, which is param, which is higher. So to paraphrase that first part, in addition to my lower nature, which was described in the prior verse, beyond that, there is another nature of mine, Sri Krishna says, which is param, which is higher. And about that may prakritim param, about my param, higher prakritim nature, about my higher nature, vidhi, please understand. He addresses Arjuna, O Arjuna, vidhi, understand now what is my higher nature. So if the lower nature were these five elements, plus the mind, intellect, and ego, what is a higher nature? He says it is jiva bhutam mahabaho. Mahabaho, O mighty Arjuna, my higher nature is jiva bhutam, that which gives existence to sentient beings, that which is the source of sentiency. That which is the source of sentiency is consciousness. Consciousness, Sri Shankara glosses, kshetrajna lakshanam, that which is characterized by the knower of all. That which is the knower of all, that consciousness through which everything and anything is known, that is jiva bhutam. Now, the prior verse made reference to mind, intellect, and ego, and these are certainly subtle aspects of the mind, but none of them are the same as consciousness. In fact, consciousness which we translate in Sanskrit, chit or chaitanya, in Satchidananda we talked about before, satchit, that word chit there means consciousness. With reference to that, I just lost my train of thought. With regard to the mind, intellect, and ahankara, these are definitely of a lower nature in the sense that they're known to you. Let's make this point very clear. This is very fundamental Vedanta, and if we don't understand this, we're not going to make any sense out of this. Anything known to you is of a lower nature. It's of a different nature than consciousness. Certainly the five elements are known. Bhumihi, anything physical. Apaha, water. Analaha, fire. Vayuhu, air. Even kam, space, akasha, in some sense, is known to us. It's known to us because we're the conscious being by whom these elements are known. What about mind? What's happening in your mind right now, is it known to you or not? It's known to you. Intellect refers to other kinds of mental activities which are very directed and controlled by you. We can say that manas and buddhi together describe the activities of your mind. The activities of your mind are known to you. They're objects, just as you know the world around you, in the same way you know the contents of your mind. How's this metaphor? You know the contents of this room, and you know the contents of your mind. The contents of this room outside and the contents of this inner room that we call mind, all of this is known to you. And in this inner room of your mind are various things like manas, mind, buddhi, intellect, and ego. Ego is that sense of being who you are. You have a life story, and you've probably narrated your life story to several friends over the years. So the one who owns that life story is what's referred to here as ahankara, ego. All of this lives in the room of your mind. It's all known. The room outside is known. The room inside your mind is known. Known to whom? That one. That one is consciousness. Kshetrajna lakshanam. Kshetrajna is a term actually used in chapter 13, which we'll see later. Kshetrajna, the knower of, literally, the knower of the field, the one who knows all experience, the knower of all experience. That's our Vedantic definition of consciousness. With that in mind, just a quick aside, because this word consciousness is very problematic today in several ways. One problematic way of problem with the word consciousness is our medical friends use the word consciousness in a very different way. So consciousness to a medical person means the ability of a person to respond. But that's a medical definition. That's not our definition. And it's meaningful in medicine. It's not meaningful to us in Vedanta. Please set that meaning aside for consciousness. Another modern, allow me to share with you a pet peeve. People talk about expanding your consciousness and having a higher consciousness. That language is very popular nowadays. And no doubt, whoever speaks these words is trying to relate to a broader vision, a higher understanding of life. Their purpose is good. But in the use of these terms, they make a confusing mess. Inadvertently, they make a mess, a very confusing mess. Why? If we define consciousness, and this is how the ancient rishis define consciousness, so if consciousness is defined as that by which everything is known, can there be a higher consciousness? Can there be an expanded consciousness? When they talk about higher consciousness and expanded consciousness, I think what they mean is higher wisdom, an expansion of your wisdom and understanding. And that certainly is meaningful. We want to expand our understanding, our compassion, our wisdom. We want to have that higher perspective on life. But that's not referring to consciousness. These are actually attributes of the mind. A mind that has an expanded vision about what life is about is a mature mind. But that mature mind, which is expanded and raised to heights, is that mind known or unknown? That mind is known. Known to whom? Consciousness. And the consciousness by which that expanded, raised, elevated mind is known, that consciousness is neither raised nor elevated nor expanded. Consciousness is. Consciousness, as understood by the Vedic rishis, consciousness is the very fabric of existence. The very fabric of existence cannot be expanded or elevated. It is. So, and we'll see much more about that when we get to chapter 13. But for now, Sri Krishna says that his param prakritam, his higher nature, is jiva bhutam, that because of which sentiency exists. And we just understood that it means consciousness. What's being said here is something so significant. Consider this. The consciousness we just discussed is a consciousness because of which you know what's happening in your mind, by which I know what's happening in my mind. This is the core of our existence as conscious beings, as sentient beings, is consciousness. We could truly say, as we discussed in the first six chapters, consciousness, Satchidananda Atma, that Chaitanya Atma, that conscious self, is the essence of who you are. And here Sri Krishna says that same consciousness is my higher nature. In the introduction to these verses, I said, in fact, with regard to that question about Satchidananda Atma, I said that that because of which you exist as a sentient being, and that because of which Ishvara exists, is the same underlying reality. And that's exactly what Sri Krishna is teaching us here. So Sri Krishna says, my lower nature is this eightfold manifestation in the form of the world around us. And he says, my higher nature is consciousness, Chaitanya consciousness. And he says, that consciousness is yaya, that by which idam jagat, this world, dharyate, that by which this world is sustained, dharyate, that which holds this world together, that which is the underlying reality because of which this world exists. I referred to it a few moments ago as the very fabric of existence. And you, that expression might confuse you, so let me comment on it briefly. The fabric of existence tends to suggest something that is like a material. You know, there's fabric out of which this chair is made, fabric out of which this cloth is made. So we might think of fabric as stuff, as material. But for the fabric of existence, whatever is a fabric, it has to be suitable for what you're making. So if you're making a chair, you use a particular kind of fabric. If you're making this Anga Vastram, you use a different kind of fabric. So for the universe, what kind of fabric is required? The universe includes not only physical stuff, but the universe includes sentiency. So the fabric for the universe must include both. The fabric for the universe must include the source of the physical stuff, and the fabric for the universe must include consciousness, the source of sentiency. So that fabric for the universe is not some kind of abstract stuff. That fabric for the universe is a conscious fabric. A conscious, anyway, we won't go too much further on that. We'll get off our track here. So that consciousness, Sri Krishna says, that is my higher nature. My lower nature is the physical manifestation. This eightfold physical manifestation is my lower nature. My higher manifestation is as consciousness. Now, next verse is one of the several verses, but these are wonderful verses. Let's continue. Etad yonini bhutani, etad yonini bhutani. Sarvani tyupadharaya, sarvani tyupa, aham kritsnasya jagataha, aham kritsnasya jagat, prabhava pralayastata, prabhava pralayastata. Etat yonini bhutani sarvani upadharaya, etat, this. This yoni, this source, the source for sarva bhutani, the source of all creatures. The source of all creatures is etat, this. Now, this means what? So Sri Krishna just talked about his lower nature and the higher nature. Ishvara's lower nature is a manifestation of five elements plus the three, the mental aspects, the subtle creation. That's the lower nature. And then he talked about his higher nature, Ishvara's higher nature, which is consciousness. And then the pronoun comes etat, this. So which one is this referring to? So if this is the source of all creatures, is this the lower nature? Or is this the higher nature? Who says it's one or the other? It's both. And for our grammarians in the class, etat here is as a pronoun, right? And it's a pronoun that's part of a compound. And a pronoun is, remember, when words enter into compounds, they lose not only their declensions, and it's a declension that tells you their number and case. So number and case are lost in a compound. So Shankara, in Shankara's commentary, I'm boring you terribly with his grammar stuff, But in Shankara's commentary, he makes it very clear that the pronoun etat refers to both the apara prakriti, the lower nature, and the para prakriti, the higher nature. He says both these are the source for all creatures. We just discussed that fabric of creation must be the source not just for physical stuff. The source of creation must be the source of sentiency as well. So you can understand then the lower nature, the apara prakriti, being the source of the stuff of the universe, and the higher nature, the consciousness, being the source of the sentiency in the universe. So etat, both of these, constitute the yoni, the source, the origin for sarva bhutani, for all creatures, for everything that exists in the universe. Iti thus upadharaya. Thus you should understand, and he's addressing Lord Krishna, addressing Arjuna, but in a manner of speaking, we're all being addressed here. We should all understand that Ishvara is the source of the stuff of the universe and the source of the sentiency, the consciousness in the universe. And he continues to say, aham, I. So Sri Krishna here speaking in the first person, definitely not as Arjuna's friend or charioteer. Sri Krishna speaking as Ishvara. He says, aham, I, kritsnasya jagataha, for the entire world, for the entire jagat. He says, I am the prabhavaha, I am the source. Pralayaha tata, and I am the pralaya, I am the dissolution. I am the source and dissolution of the entire universe. Now, we've heard this language before, and if we merely plunge ahead in this text, we will lose an opportunity to really understand. Who is this Ishvara we're talking about? Ishvara as the source of creation, as the underlying fabric for it, the fabric of existence of the universe. What does that mean? We've already identified these two elements, the apara prakriti, the lower nature, which you said is the origin of the stuff of the universe. And we've talked about the para prakriti, the higher nature, the source of the sentience here, consciousness of the universe. Here we have a great point to pause and really understand who is Ishvara as the abhinna nimitta upadana jagat karanam. I'll explain. If you understand that word, you understand a lot of Vedanta. You will understand it by the end of this next discussion. What it means, abhinna, non-separate, nimitta upadana karana, the cause of the universe, the upadana karana, the source of the material of the universe, stuff of the universe, and nimitta karana, the source of the intelligence of the universe, the sentiency of the universe. This is such an important teaching about the nature of Ishvara. And before I give you this teaching, let's just observe something that you may take for granted. Here, we're about to see some very solid, basic teachings from the ancient rishis teaching about who and what is Ishvara, the God of the cosmos. And what I think is so striking about this is its difference from other religious traditions. And here I have to go back and to my earlier observation. I said I was raised as a Roman Catholic. And in that tradition, in fact, in all the Christian traditions, if you ask who is God, they say, you know, God is all-powerful, almighty, etc., etc. But who is that all-powerful, almighty God? Oh, he's all-powerful. Okay, then what? He's almighty. Then what? He's the God of the cosmos. Okay, who is it? What is it? Please teach me. That is absent in many other religious traditions. You may take this for granted, that the fact that it's explicitly taught by the ancient rishis. they did not, and here's the significance, they didn't leave this as a matter of Shraddha. Oh, you just have to believe in God. And isn't that what many religious traditions say? Don't ask all of these questions. I was told this as a little boy. Don't ask these questions. You just have to believe. And many religious traditions adopt that perspective, which is really unfortunate, in my opinion. And when, and just to finish with a little bit of a personal story, so I eventually was turned off by the religion of my childhood because that religion was unable to address my questions. So I became as a, I suppose, as a teenager and young adult, I became what we would call agnostic. If you ask me, agnostic means I don't know. Does God exist? I don't know. Does God not exist? I don't know. I don't know. And one thing that drew me to the teachings of Vedanta, especially when I started listening to my guru, Pujya Swami Dayananda, is he didn't say, oh, you just have to believe this stuff. He says, listen, I will teach you. And that applies even to teachings about who and what is Ishvara. We're not told merely to believe. We're invited to understand. And to finish my personal story, this was so crucial to me as a young adult because I was disinclined to believe in anything because of my childhood religious experience was not a positive one. It was like shoved down my throat, you just have to believe this, don't ask questions. That ended up having a negative effect upon me, as it does upon many people. And so when I came to the teachings of Vedanta, if my guru had said, listen carefully because you have to believe what I'm going to tell you, I would have run out of the lecture hall. Obviously, that's not what he said. What he said is, this is to be understood. Ishvara is to be understood. So let's begin. How? Can we really and truly understand Ishvara as the Jagat Karanam, as the source of the universe, the language used here, Prabhavaha, Pralayaha, Tata, as the source and dissolution of the entire universe? So we're going to, I think we have time. We're going to go through some of these. It's a little bit, not terribly technical. The expression, by the way, I used before, and we'll see if we can understand this. Abhinna nimitta upadana karanam Ishvaraha. So, if we can understand this expression in the next 20 minutes, we're doing really good. Let's try. Actually, we don't even have 20 minutes. We'll see how far we get here. These two words, we've referred several times to a source for the material. Upadana means the source for the material of the universe. Material. And nimitta means the source of the intelligence. Actually, the word karana means that source or cause. So that which is the karana, the cause or source, for the material because of which the universe exists, and that which is the source or cause because of which the intelligence of the universe exists. And the one we call Ishvara, the God of the cosmos, is the one who is both. Abhinna means non-separate. The one who is simultaneously the source of the material because of which the universe exists, and the one who is the source of the intelligence, the consciousness because of which the universe exists. And to understand this, we're going to start with a very simple metaphor and work our way up. Let's see what happens. So for every creation, there is a creator. For every creation, there must be an upadana karana and a nimitta karana. For any creation, there must be a source of the material and a source of the intelligence. So we start with our favorite example, the mridghata, clay pot. Mridghata. So the clay pot. The clay pot has an upadana karana and a nimitta karana. The upadana karana, the material cause for the pot, is clay. No problem. There's also a nimitta karana, an intelligent cause, a source of the intelligence. And who was the one who put the clay into this particular form was a potter. So for the existence of this pot, both these factors were required. Material, clay, and intelligence in the form of the pot maker. If you remove either one of these factors, you don't get a pot. And this applies to any creation. For any creation, you require these two factors, upadana, nimitta. To make cloth, you require upadana. What is the upadana karana for cloth? Thread, right? You also require a nimitta karana. Who is the nimitta karana for cloth? Would be the weaver, or the one who designs the weaving machines, since it's all done by machines nowadays. A source of that intelligence. This applies to any creation. Even how about a computer chip? What is the upadana for the computer chip? Would be silicon and copper and aluminum and whatever else goes into the chip. But if you take if you put some copper and silicon and aluminum in your mixie, you're not going to get a computer chip because it takes a great deal of intelligence to fashion that computer chip. So that intelligence is the nimitta karana. So this can apply to any creation. But now we started with this pot metaphor, and this pot metaphor has a real flaw. Non-separate. We said that Ishvara is simultaneously the source of the material and the source of the intelligence. Is that true for the pot? Clay is one thing, and the potter is another. Bhinna. That's different. We understand Ishvara to be simultaneously both the source of the material and intelligence. So we see a limitation in the example of the pot. And then we find in the Mundaka Upanishad, we see another metaphor, a very interesting metaphor that attempts to resolve this problem. And the example given there is Urnanabihi Srijate Grinatecha. Urnana is a spider. The spider is a creator of a web. And what's different is when the potter makes the clay, the potter has the intelligence to make... When the potter makes a pot, the potter has the intelligence to make the pot, but the potter has to go outside to get the clay. The spider has the intelligence to make a web. By the way, how big is a spider's brain? And in spite of that, they weave these amazing webs. They're smart enough to create these incredible webs. So the spider is the nimitta karana, is the source of the intelligence for the web. Where does the spider go to get the material? Got it. So in that metaphor, the spider is the abhinna nimitta upadana karana. The spider is simultaneously the source of the material and the source of the intelligence, unlike the potter. But we end up giving up this metaphor also because it's got another defect. And the defect of this further metaphor is this. Have you ever seen a web without a spider? Many times. The spider can create the web, and a spider can leave the web behind. Is that our concept of Ishvara? God created the world, and then he went on holiday. How silly is that? So abhinna has another meaning here. Abhinna literally means non-separate. And here the word abhinna can have a further meaning. The meaning of Ishvara, who is abhinna, non-separate from his creation. You can't say that about the... First of all, you can't say that about the potter. The potter is over here. The pot is over there. You can't say that about the spider. The web is over there. The spider is over here. But with regard to Ishvara, Ishvara is abhinna, non-separate from his own creation. So we have to give up those metaphors. Every metaphor, just as a philosophical observation, every metaphor is defective. If a metaphor were not defective, it wouldn't be a metaphor. It would be the actual thing, right? So metaphor, examples, illustrations are to lead us towards what we want to understand. But we don't cling to the metaphors because we want to get to the thing. It's like you don't want to get stuck on the rungs of a ladder. You want to climb to the top of the ladder. Every drishtanta is a word we use in Sanskrit for metaphor. Every drishtanta is a rung of a ladder. None of the rungs are identical with the goal. They lead us to the goal. So the potter example was one rung. The spider example was a further rung. Now we come to the third rung, which is the last of the rungs we'll talk about. And the third metaphor is that of a dream. When you dream, you are the creator of your dream world. Let's examine that the relationship between your dream world and you. When you dream about stuff. In your dream, there are houses and people and all of that. So tell me, the houses and people and cars and streets in your dream are made of what? A dream house is made of dream wood. Fine, what is the dream wood made of? Ultimately, everything in a dream is made of you, your mind stuff, your consciousness. For everything that exists in your dream world, you are the upadana karana. You are the stuff out of which the dream world is fashioned. And not only the stuff, whatever you dream about is born of your intelligence. The plot of your dream, the characters of your dream, whatever unfolds in your dream, the fact that the dream wood in your dream is fashioned into a house. It takes a lot of intelligence to build a house. Can you build a house? In a dream, you can. In a dream, you build a very nice house. In a dream, you build a car. In a dream, you build any number of things. You are the source for the intelligence of everything in your dream world. For your dream, you are the upadana karana. You are the source of the material because of which everything in your dream exists. And you are the nimitta karana, the source of the intelligence because of which your dream world exists. And abhinna, you are the source of both. Both the stuff and the intelligence come from you. And then what is the final part? Where is the dream relative to you? The dream and you. The dream is non-separate from you. In fact, the dream is made from you. You are in the dream house. The dream house is made of you. The dream car is made of you. The dream characters are made of you. It's all you. It's all non-separate from you. And to see the last line of this verse, Sri Krishna says, I am the Prabhavaha, I'm the origin and Pralayaha and dissolution. Tell me, what happens to the dream creation when you wake up? Huh? That dream world comes from you. That dream world is sustained by you. That dream world returns to you. Now, this still is a drishtanta. We do not say, the rishis are not saying that the world is a dream. This is the limitation of the metaphor. We said every metaphor is a rung on a ladder. It's not the goal. So don't get stuck. Don't say, oh, this is Ishvara's dream. It's not Ishvara's dream. Dream is a metaphor to help us understand. And there's actually a lot more to be understood here. So the time is getting late. What we're going to do now is, let's wrap up this class here. But this is such an important drishtanta that in our next class, we're going to come right back to this dream metaphor, expand upon it, because I think it's one of the best ways to really understand who and what is Ishvara. Just a concluding comment. Here we've been talking about Ishvara for the next half an hour, for the last half hour. In the last half hour, what were you asked to believe about Ishvara? Isn't that interesting? We talked about Ishvara for half an hour, and you weren't asked to believe anything. This is something to be understood. And there's quite a bit more to be understood. So we will come back to the dream metaphor in our next lesson and continue with our text. A couple of quick announcements here. Tomorrow, Sunday, we have our Gita at Work discussion group, our study group. Our Gita at Work study group will meet at 11 o'clock. And then tomorrow at 6 p.m., I'll be conducting satsang, a question-answer session. If you have any questions, please come at 6 p.m. The library will be open after class, and we'll conclude with our prayers.